You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. Tracy, as you well know at this point, and as our listeners well know at this point, nothing gets me going like a Southern accent. It just brings to mind all the stuff. In this case today, believe it or not, it brought to mind, like, because I've been doing this for a long time. I've done a lot of different things. It brings to mind when I was at a writer's conference with Joe Lansdale and Jeff Lindsay.
Oh, okay.
And the organizers, we were doing a podcast, and the organizers just said, could you have a Southern off? And we said, sure. And the three of us spent about 10 minutes just trying to come up with Southernisms that the others had never heard before.
Oh,
you know, this goes beyond Bless Your Heart.
Oh, yeah.
And but it was hilarious and fun. And so that's where my brain went this morning as I was chatting with our guest in the green room.
Well, I mean, of course it would. And as we also covered in the green room, I mean, we've all got little bits and pieces of places we've been and things we've done. But Lord, Faith Hunter, you've been everywhere, haven't you?
Well, if the Southeast counts as everywhere, I absolutely have. I was born in Southwest Louisiana and then lived all over the Gulf States before I ended up in South Carolina. And now we have property in the mountains of South Carolina. And so I have every form of hard, soft, angry, jittery, fast-talking, slow-talking Southern accent you can imagine. Occasionally, I will even throw in a little lilt just to, you know, soften it some. Because, yeah, I talk very Southern. Sorry, y'all.
and she pronounces Louisiana correctly.
That I do. Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although Northwest Louisiana, people pronounce it Louisiana, believe it or not.
Oh.
So it depends on where you're from.
Aren't they basically just Texans at that point, though?
Well, yeah.
I mean, I won't tell them that.
Yeah, well, they do wear a lot of boots.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. I can. I will not disagree with that. So
okay.
My dad's from the Shreveport area. So, yeah.
It's like my uncle that I grew up around who was from Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And so that's why for my entire life, I've always said Missouri instead of Missouri. Mm-hmm. Because he lived in Caruthersville, Missouri for a very, very long time. And I have a friend now who games with me who was born in that state. And he says Missouri. And I always correct him and say Missouri.
Well, it depends on what part of the state you're from, I guess.
Yes, it does. Yeah, it does.
So,
yeah, it does.
I'm from Louisiana. My dad was from Louisiana.
Yeah.
Very weird.
And I always say Louisville.
Ah, well, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who doesn't say Louisville just literally doesn't know what's like. I think that's like that's the bottom tier level of Southern off right there. Like, I think a full blown Yankee should be able to get Louisville right.
But now there's Louisville and Louisville.
Mm. Yeah.
You hear both of those. And I'm sorry, it's Louisville.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Louisville. Where I'm from, Louisville.
Well, I went to college in Southern Indiana, so I know better. So there we have it. All right. So thinking about the kind of like literal territory here that you're covering with your life, you've also covered a ton of literal territory with your career. But your most recent release, Unpredictable Magic, is interesting because it's in some ways something completely new, but also a return to work that you have really kind of established yourself and established your readership with, because it is out of the Jane Yellowrock sort of narrative universe here. Can you give us a crash course real quick on Unpredictable Magic for our listeners?
Unpredictable Magic takes the readers back to the original Jane Yellowrock world, but then we jump 20 years into the future and enter the lives of Angie Baby and EJ, who are now known as Angie or Ange and EJ still. But they are grown up post-witch war world, and they are living in Chattanooga. They have a paranormal detective agency that they want to support themselves so they no longer have to be a part of what their childhood was, which is a part of the Queen's world, which is a part of their family, magical coven. They want to be on their own. They want to be independent. But, you know, our pasts always catch up with us. And theirs comes calling. So that's where we open the book at, oh my, the past comes calling.
And in Chattanooga, which is one of my favorite places. I lived there for many years.
I love Chattanooga. I used to go to Chattacon with a fair amount of regularity. And then I have a niece who lives there. So I've been, it's part of the mountains, whitewater kayak. So going up into that area is part of the fun of still living life as much on the edge as a person of my unnamed years can.
I lived off of just near the Chickamauga.
Nice.
On the lake. And my cousin and his best friend both had boats. So I didn't have to buy a boat. I could just check out what they were doing on the weekend and go with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I lived there when they did the Riverwalk, which was the big concert thing that they used to do in downtown Chattanooga. And that's where I first heard Kenny Wayne Shepherd, which is one of my favorite blues guitarists now.
Nice. Very nice.
Chattanooga was a great town.
I don't know if it still is, but last time I was there, it was. So yeah. I'm just going to say yes. Although the world is changing drastically everywhere, I don't think there's been a witch war in Chattanooga. So it won't be like what I've made it into.
Right.
Sure.
There is that. So, okay. Confession time. Never been to Chattanooga. So I'm odd woman out in all of this.
That's the first place I was ever able to make my joke. Look out, mountain.
Oh, no. Oh, Patrick Louise. Must you? Wow. Okay. No, it's okay. I've recovered. I have a question now. My brain is resetting from that. But like one of the things that really interests me about Unpredictable Magic is the fact of it being set in Chattanooga, because I think in this sort of, broadly speaking, like urban fantasy milieu, there's so much of what we think of as the story is bound up not just in the characters, but in like the place and space that's rendered unusual and magical through all of the inventions of the author. And we've had New York, we've had Chicago, we've had LA, we've had St. Louis, we've had New Orleans, we've had so many different really well-known and iconic cities sort of grasped into the urban fantasy world. But I've never seen a Chattanooga in the urban fantasy world. And so I'm kind of interested in what you feel like Chattanooga has to offer here that makes it really well-suited to the story you're out to tell.
It's close to everywhere. It's close to Atlanta for your arts and your education, and yet it's right there in the mountains where you can go hiking and get lost if you want to for an afternoon or the rest of your life, if that's your choice. It's not far from Asheville. Well, it is. It's a long drive, but as the crow flies, it's not very far.
The mountains have different opinions about how far it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Everybody, it depends on where you start and how many gradients you're willing to climb. But it's not too far from Knoxville, which is another place I placed a series. So I've got series in Asheville, Knoxville, and now Chattanooga. And that allows me to bring in characters from EJ and Angie's past that can cause them conflict, that can cause them trouble, because they've got the Dark Queen of the Vampires who's living in Asheville, and their grandfather who is living in Asheville. And then they've got their Uncle Ricky Bo, who's living in Knoxville, and they're close to all kinds of trouble if they want to get into trouble, and I think they do. So.
The thing I've always felt, Tracy, about the particular area that she's talking about, I think the point is, it kind of like Denver, where I'm living now, You are always 30 minutes away from wilderness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Drive 30 minutes, park your car, put on a backpack and go, and you're gone.
Yeah. Because when I talk about Chickamauga, I mean, there's so many little tributaries and little mm-hmm. creeks and different things that are all over there that you can just find and go and hike. And yeah, the difference between that and here is green.
Yeah.
There's so much green there versus here where everything is, you know, because we're in drought. It's just, and even when we're not in drought, there's no green. There's like a 30-day window for green in Colorado. But there, everything is green. Everything is lush. Everything is dense. Yeah. There's a reason Chattanooga is one of my favorite places to live.
Yeah.
I feel like we should have contacted the city council of Chattanooga to get an endorsement deal on this episode. Like, I think we're kind of doing them a solid.
Unless I'm horribly mistaken, Sherry Priest is still living there. I think she still lives there in Chattanooga near Lookout Mountain.
I think you're right. I had forgotten that, but yeah.
So like there, it has drawn other authors in, but I don't know of another story set in Chattanooga at this point. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Well, I like the city of Chattanooga too, because while it's spread out, it does have its downtown area or uptown, mm-hmm. and it's there with all where all the history is. So for the area, and it's just a neat place to go. It's a neat place to visit. It's a neat place to have a conference. For the writers' conferences that are there. And I just decided this is the street I want my characters to live on. And I decided that probably 15 years ago, before I ever knew I was going to put a book, before I ever knew which characters were going to live on this street. I walked down it and I thought, this is the perfect street for city-dwelling country people to live on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was aligned with the sunset. It was wonderful. I loved everything about it. I was really, really happy to go back there in my imagination.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I'd like to go back there and get a real Hardee's biscuit, not one of those stupid Carl's Jr. ones that are terrible.
Even our fast food people know how to make good biscuits, I have to say. I don't know. I doubt you can ever get a good biscuit anywhere but the Southeast. There's something about the flour and the humidity in the air.
I've heard that White Lily is the brand to go by.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Or Adla.
Okay.
Adla flour, Adla mm-hmm. biscuit flour can, and there are people who will fight over that. So mm-hmm. we'll just, mm-hmm. I have to mention both because I will not be known to be drawn in on either side.
Well, in that case, let's talk about mayonnaise. No, just kidding.
I'm sorry. I'm going to talk to you about mayonnaise. It's dicks all the way. And that's the South Carolina girl in me talking there. I don't really know where else Dukes is.
Yeah, yeah. I was, So I mentioned in a different recording we did recently that my family just got HBO Max, which is, it's sort of unusual for us. We're not usually the type to keep adding streaming services. We usually pare down. But for various reasons, we threw this one onto the pile of recurring charges. And one of the things that I was deeply delighted to discover that they had on HBO Max was they have the entire 16-season run of Alton Brown's Good Eats, which I don't know. How much of a touchstone that is for either of you, but when I was a teenager in the 90s, my family watched every single Good Eats that there was. And it was kind of fed by the fact that we were nerdy in a somewhat sciencey way and also really interested in food. And it kind of scratched a lot of those itches. And we were watching an episode last night, my husband and I, because my daughter, this is a whole other thing, Patrick, but Deirdre doesn't like Good Eats. What's wrong with her? What's wrong with this child? Is she mine? What has happened? Anyway, so Husbeast stuck it out and was like, fine, I'll watch some of this with you. And he didn't even mean to get sucked in. And like four episodes later, he's like, I can't stop watching.
It's great.
I'm getting to the episode that we ended the night with was the episode in season one where he's making biscuits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, he's making biscuits in a kind of ad hoc competition with his grandma. Who's like 80, And my understanding is that Alton Brown's originally from Atlanta. And so she's a nice old Georgia woman who gets drug onto this, her grandson's brand new cooking show. And she just, she is a stitch. And she has absolutely, she's not impressed that he's got his own television show. And he's like, all right, this is my mom, eh? And she's been making biscuits since Ulysses S. Grant. And she's like, shut your mouth. And it was, if you could find a way to find this specific episode in season one, I think it's like episode 4 or 5. It is hilarious. And they're side by side doing stuff, and he's got a scale and he's tearing the scale and he's putting stuff in it. And he's like, I'm going to use both shortening and butter. And she's like, sucking her teeth next to him, and she's not impressed.
That sound.
Big workbench, and they put duct tape down the center, so he's got his side. His side is just all these damn contraptions and stuff going on, and she's just like, I got this bucket of lard and a bunch of self-rising flour, and here's some buttermilk, and she's not measuring a blam thing. Nope. And it's just, they get done and make all their biscuits, and they're sitting down at the table, and he's got his basket of biscuits and she's got hers, and they look lovely, all of them. And he's like, well, Mame, do you want to try my biscuits? And she's like, why would I want to try one of them things? she's roasting this man on his own television show. Oh, bless that woman.
See, I remember, I had two Meemaws. So, Meemaw Tommy and Meemaw Pal, or different people say it different ways. Meemaw, Meemaw. We said Meemaw.
In South Louisiana, it's Meemaw.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I just remember whenever we go to Meemaw Pal's house, she was this tiny, tiny, tiny little woman. And she always had the handkerchief around her hair. Mm,
yep.
You know, tiny. She always had an apron on, and she'd say, are you all hungry? And, you know, someone would say, I could eat. And she'd go in the kitchen and she'd get a cast iron skillet, put it down, and she'd do a big old scoop of lard, and she'd put it in the skillet and turn it on. And then she'd say, what do you want?
whatever it is
starting with that big old scoop of lard that's
because
going in that.
You can always add some bacon grease from the bacon grease jar on the stove if you need flavoring. But sometimes you don't want bacon flavoring, although I have to say that's pretty rare. But I had the mama who cooked seafood on the back porch because it was always too hot to cook in the house.
Sure.
So you did all your cooking on the back porch in the summertime, and she would just boil up some water and throw in some vegetables and look at it and stir it, and then she'd start dropping in crabs or whatever she pulled out of the bay.
Yeah.
Bay was literally across the street from her house when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. So we had fresh food out on the – what was really a porch, a car porch, but I don't think the car was ever in there.
It was
I can't help but think, if you're growing up right across the street from where your grandma's house is and can see her with her giant pot over a fire throwing this, that, and the other thing into it, how could you not grow up writing about witches? I mean,
I mean, my great-grandma was, as far as definitions go, was a bayou witch. Mm-hmm. She was mean as a snake and twice as tough, and she did good things and bad things in her life, but she knew how to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tough women in my family line.
I think there's tough women in general in the South. Because it's just something that, you know, maybe it's a harder life or something. I don't know. I remember, you know, like I said, Meemaw Powell was this very sweet older woman who would always cook for us. And Meemaw Tommy was the one that if you misbehaved, you go cut a switch.
Yeah.
And depending on how you misbehaved, it was either you cut it from this bush or you cut it from the rose bush.
Oof.
Ooh, yeah. So she did not mess around at all. And you behaved when you were at Meemaw Tommy's house.
Mine was more benign neglect.
Okay.
Because there was land all around them. I would go across the street to, oh goodness, what was her name? Not Bourdain. Oh shoot, I've forgotten it. It had a Cajun lady across the street, and I could go one house. She said, "Oh, little girl, you come on in this house. You want some tea? I got some sweet tea for you." And then at the others, it was take your fishing pole and go down and sit on the dock and fish, or play in the huge garden. Play meaning with a hoe.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Play meant digging up.
Yeah.
The weeds.
We're playing this game called Get the Plants That Look Like That.
That's right. And then you would pick your plants. The first thing in the morning, you go out and pick your plants. That's where I tried my first hot pepper from that garden. So one grandpa had bees, got to see how bees were done. So it was, although both of them lived in technically a city, back then there was land attached to each small house. And you might have a 3-acre garden.
Yeah.
Or you might just have a huge back porch with cherry tomatoes on vines growing all over the place.
Yeah.
That was the thing that was always a trip, because we moved to California and we had a garden. We had tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers and all this stuff that my grandmother and my mom would just grow in this. We had a huge garden. None of my friends had gardens.
Mm-hmm.
No, like I would go over to other people's houses. They did not have these things, but right. Mom and Grams always made sure that there was a garden growing in whatever house we were renting. There was a garden in the backyard. Like they did that. And we would eat, you know, those fresh vegetables.
Mm-hmm. I had a garden here until the trees grew up. We've lived in this house for over 30 years. And when we moved in, I put in a garden patch. My husband just kind of rolled his eyes, but I had lettuces and tomatoes and peppers and huge lettuces. I mean, I had a 5x5 foot patch of just pure lettuce.
Wow.
It was 20 feet long, my garden. So, which doesn't sound like much, but for two people, that's a pretty big garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the trees grew up and now there's no sun. So I've transferred my deep desire to grow things to Japanese maples.
Oh, yeah.
35 Japanese maples on the property. So I've gone from being able to feed myself to working with plants that won't give me anything to eat at all. And all they want to do is die. You have to love them all the time.
They're very dramatic.
Yeah. They are. They're quite dramatic in every way.
See, I've always said,
a lot of attention.
I've always said that I think that the gardening gene, I thought it skipped a generation, but what's funny is my grandmother and my mom were great at it. I'm terrible at it. Everything that I try to grow dies. So I've when mom passed on, like she had moved in here and she originally had a garden and then she had a lot of plants and stuff. And when she passed, I did everything that she did and all those plants died.
Now, did you talk to them properly?
I talked to them. I talked to my animals. I talked to inanimate objects. You name it. I talked to it.
Did you not let them communicate with their pen pals, the Japanese maples that Faith has got? Because maybe they got lonely. Were they not on the group text together anymore? Like,
I have to say, when I started with the Japanese maples, I lost about 30% the first 2 years.
Oof.
So learning what they want and what they can stand and how hardy they are or are not and how much shade they need and how much sunlight they don't need. When to water them, when not to water them. It was a very expensive hobby, but I'm beginning to get the gist of it and the everything I have planted in the ground, but two have survived this year and one has a cap, and I don't think it's going to make it. And the other one just didn't have a root when I planted it.
Oh, rude.
Wow. Yeah, it came. It had been in the pot for a year, and when I pulled it out, there's no root. I don't how it was alive. It was weird. Anyway, okay.
So hold on.
A lot of green stuff in growing things in my books. Can you tell?
And this is kind of the point that – so Tracy warned you that I squirrel. I do squirrel.
Yeah.
But kind of the point of all this, you know, kind of talking about Southern culture and just really the deep roots that tend to happen is that that is a rich kind of history to pull from and put into these books.
And it's a history that combines with the fact that unpredictable magic is the future history of a story world that you'd already developed. And so I think what's interesting here, and I'd love to hear you unpack a little bit, is what it's a book that can do, hopefully, two really important things. One, it can continue this narrative world for people who have been with you through the Jane Yellow Rock books. But it can also onboard people who have never seen those books before. It can potentially be an entry point. And I'm kind of wondering how that did or didn't factor into the choices that you were making as you wrote.
Normally, let me back up just a little bit from that question. Normally,
sure.
When I write a book, I have a vision for it before I put ever pen to paper or fingers to keyboard. I know generally what the characters are. I know generally that the bad guy is going to be decimated in some horrific way. And I know generally where the book is going to be set. It's all this broad-based stuff. And then I write an outline. Mm-hmm. I am normally a complete outliner from beginning to end. But when I finished the Jane Yellow Rock series and the Soulwood series, which were based in generally the same world, I had no idea if I was going to quit writing, if I could even find it in me to do a new book. Life had thrown me lots of curves in the last 5 years of writing those books. So I just told my agent I might be done. And she said, "You're not done." I said, "I might be." She said, "You're not done." I said, "So what am I supposed to write? I've been thinking about it. There's nothing that I want to write." She said, "Just sit down and write for fun. Don't think about selling it. Don't think about take some characters into the future. Just, you don't even have to use it. Just write and then you can throw it away." So I went to a totally different world, not this one. I went to a world with flying goats and mini dragons, mini as in small, mini dragons, if you will. And I started a book called Second Chances and Flying Goats because it was the only thing I could do to clear my head. And 30, 40 pages in, I quit. And I said, "Okay, this is silly, but I like it. What else can I do? I still need to clear my head." And I thought, "All right, I'm just going to start writing a character I know. I'm going to move it to a different town that I like. Oh, yeah, there's that street in Chattanooga that grabbed me. I'm going to put Angie Baby on that street in Chattanooga." And I threw myself into writing, and suddenly I had 100 pages of jibber jabber. And it was jibber jabber. And I thought, "All right, I'm going to clean both of these up, send them to my agent just for fun, because nobody's ever going to want either of these." And she said, she sent me back revision letters for both. And I said, "Oh, okay."
So, not a fan of flying goats, was she?
Is this going to happen? So I revised both of them according to her recommendations, and she sent them into my agent, and I mean to my editor, and my editor sent back a revision letter, and I revised that according to her preferences, and suddenly I realized I had two books that I could sell shortly. And so they bought three books. I don't know what the third book's going to be about. I haven't told you yet. But I got two books, and it was like there's these there's this world that I love that I was done with, but it's a different world because it's different people. And all these awful things have happened and all these wonderful things have happened. And so here's the world moving forward. And I like that. Mm-hmm. And then here's this other world that is a dark paranormal cozy. There's no such thing. So I have to name it myself, about a septuagenarian and her 28-year-old niece who end up having to fight a paranormal cartel together. I have no idea where they came from, but there they were. And it was this out of nowhere for the Angie Baby and EJ book. I knew what I didn't want. I didn't want what fans expected.
Sure.
I didn't want a plethora of old characters from the Jane world to be a part of it. But I also knew that these weren't children grown up in an orphanage like Jane did. These were people with very full early lives, very different from what the average kid grows up in. They grew up in a royal court of vampires. They grew up in a coven of people who were called witches because they could do things with mathematics and the power of their minds that other people couldn't. So, yeah, I would love to draw people back into Jane's world, which is a world of vampires, and back into Angie's and Molly's world, which is sort of an offshoot of Jane's, with the witches and how they avoid the evil of power that calls to you and breaks you and makes you into something you don't want to be, and how they avoid that. And then maybe a little bit of the Soulwood world, where the magic is all about the magic of the earth and the magic of growing things that humans seem to have lost a lot of. So it's brand new. It has a lot of backstory because these characters' lives were full of backstory. They didn't sit on the couch and twiddle their thumbs or play games or watch movies. These were people who had to learn to fight at a young age. They were kids who grew up learning who was good, who was safe, who was bad, who was dangerous, and how to handle all of them. Mm-hmm. So their backstory was intense and vibrant. I didn't want to lose any of that.
Mm-hmm. So you're giving us book. you're giving people a lot to chew on. But
So here, like, one of the things that I took away from what you were just sharing with us, and thank you for sharing that with us, because Tracy and I are both writers, and I have no qualms saying Tracy's a more accomplished writer than I am. And she had, because she had an agent, she had a publishing contract. Mine was very, very different, the way that my book got published through a publisher. And, but what, like, we talk a lot about writing. We talk a lot about how people write because it's different for everybody. Like, everybody's different. And what I heard from you is that, like, you had to try something different because you were at a point where you just didn't know what you were going to do. And it reminded me many, many, many years ago when my mother moved to Colorado. You know, one of the things that she wanted was, like, one day she's like, I want beans and cornbread. And I'm like, okay. And so she goes out and she buys, you know, the package of dry beans and everything. And she starts prepping. And she gets the ham hock. And she's getting all the stuff together and she's trying to make me, and she hated it. And she's like, I hate Colorado because I can't make beans properly, you know, because we are at higher elevation. You got to do it a little bit differently. And so I want to say for like 2 weeks, all I heard was how beans and cornbread was too hard to make here. And it was this and that. And, for whatever reason, that sparked a thing in my head. And I sat down and I wrote a story about a witch in Kentucky that starts with her making beans and cornbread.
I love it.
You never know. You never know what's going to spark that creative juice and flow for you. You don't know. And that's kind of the magic of it, right? That's the magic of writing. You don't know what's going to spark that and get you going.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I remember once I was stuck inside a book when I was writing as Gwen. I was writing a Southern, closest I can come is Southern thriller literature. My character had been kidnapped, was in a bayou with a man who was very dangerous, and he was such a horrible human being. I wanted him to, I'm not sure if I can say this, I wanted him to become unalive, very uniquely. Sure.
And
with prejudice.
Yeah. Hmm.
And I was watching a fire on the news, and it came to me how I was going to handle this really horrible, horrible human being. And I will say he became no longer a part of this world in the best, most exciting way ever. And I can't say it on your show because just too much that you would have to cut out. I'm sorry.
Hey, you know what? One day I'm sitting with mom. This is when she was not able to get around as much, and she loved watching old Westerns. Mm-hmm. And the Sons of Katie Elder came on, and I'm like, Mom, we're watching the Sons of Katie Elder. We're going to watch this. And so we're watching it. And I thought, what if we had like something like that, but in space, like a space Western cowboy thing. And that's when I wrote my first Cord Cahill novella. Like that again, you never know what's going to spark something in an idea that goes in your head.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And I love beans and can't eat cornbread. I'm allergic to corn, but beans and rice. Now that's a Louisiana staple.
Right? Oh, yes, it is.
Sure. Yeah, in fact, I've got some in my freezer. I mean, my refrigerator. I made some a couple of days ago, beans and white rice.
It's funny because I've told Tracy this multiple times now recently. I said the Popeye's chicken has won the chicken war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Popeye's chicken is the best chicken, and I'm addicted to their chicken sandwich and their Cajun fries and all that. Yep. And so I'm avoiding a road.
Yeah.
I avoid it now because I'm like, if I'm over on that road, I'm going to stop at Popeye's. I'm going to get that damn chicken sandwich.
Right. my grandpa was always into, of course they weren't around when he was young, but when I was a little bit older, he was always into Popeye's chicken. Mm-hmm. And I can't eat food from fast food places because of the corn oil.
Sure.
But I can surely make my own at home.
Yes.
And I cook from scratch now because I have to. I'm not particularly good at it, I'll just tell you, because I can't make things hot. My husband can't eat hot foods. Everything needs to be hot because I'm from Louisiana.
Yeah.
So I've had to learn to cook bland. But I keep all the spices on the side, and I can ameliorate my meals so that we can both have food that's edible.
Well, it's a good thing that you're a good sport about that.
Yeah. Well, I don't want him dead. There's so many spices he can't eat at all. So we have to cook. I have to cook separate for us. So everything is pretty much from scratch these days.
Yeah, yeah. See, I think if I'd grown up either in Chicago or in Kentucky, I think I would have been a bland eater. But having moved to California, Mexican food was huge. There was a lot of Asian influence as well. So a lot of Thai and different things. And so I do love my spice. And
Mexican food that just nearly killed me, but that's full of corn.
When I moved to Tennessee and I went to a Mexican restaurant, I was brokenhearted. I was like, what is happening here? What is that? And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it's so bland. And they're like, where are you from? And I said, well, I grew up in California. They're like, oh yeah, yeah. They won't eat that here. They won't eat that here. They can't. Come on your birthday. We'll make it for you special. And that's what they did. Like on my birthday, they would make me spicy, spicy stuff. Yeah.
Love it.
Nice. Nice.
There's a place close by that makes black bean soup. Mm-hmm. That is to die for. Now, I make a good black bean soup, but theirs has all the spicy spices in it. And then they bring you a little bottle of something even spicier, a little habanero right there.
Yeah.
Put as much as you want in. Oh, it's marvelous. We're not talking about books at all.
No, honestly, we tend to be about 50% books, 50%, you know, food, pets, travel, politics, what's on TV. It's a bit of a hodgepodge around here. We only claim to be functional, after all. I mean, it's not a high bar. It's just functional. I love it.
Well, functional is pretty high bar these days. So
I guess so. I bet we can do one better than functional by advising people on some picks of the week.
We'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it. A lot of other people are enjoying it. But our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us and we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
All right. So Patrick, what are you feeling for your pick of the week?
I am picking a book, but it's a different kind of book. So as you mentioned earlier, I'm an RPG person. I love to play games. I'm going to be playing Pathfinder later on today. And they have recently released Paizo is the company that does Pathfinder. They recently released Impossible Magic. And this is a new supplemental book that they have gone through what's called the remaster. They've distanced themselves from Dungeons and Dragons by renaming things so that they don't have to pay Hasbro any money.
That's very smart.
Yeah. And so the remaster, this is what Impossible Magic is. It's remastering four different character classes. The Necromancer, the Magus, which is a wizard with a sword. The Summoner, this is a person who can summon divine or infernal beings to fight on their behalf. And the Runesmith, this is a person who can quickly draw symbols that cast magic. It's a very cool book. It has not hit the streets yet. It doesn't come out physically until, I believe, the 30th. Okay. But since I'm a subscriber to Paizo.com, I get the PDF early. Ooh. And so I've been going through that because I have really wanted to play Amagus for a very, very long time. They're very cool. They, like I said, they're kind of like Zorro in the way that they use their sword. However, their sword gets imbued with magic and actually casts a spell when they strike.
Nice.
Which is
like
very
a lot of
neat.
The mythological swords of history.
Yeah, it's very cool, very different. They have things where they can sort of they can disappear in front of you and pop up behind you and just do all this weird, crazy mixture of sword styles and magic. And I've just been ridiculously excited for this book to come out. So Impossible Magic from Paizo. That's my pick this week.
Fun. Love it. All right. So Faith, how about you? What has been bringing you joy?
Well, two things. Mm-hmm. I am doing the slow read of This Kingdom Shall Not Kill Me by Alona Andrews. Mm-hmm. I did the first one. I did the first read quite some time ago, and now I'm doing the slow read because there's so much to take from this book. I'm having a good time with it. And sitting on the porch in the rain, we've been in real drought all summer. Everything is dry and dying. And two days ago, it started raining, and I've actually had to bundle up because it's dropped below 75.
Oh.
So I bundled up on the porch and I have had my morning tea out on the porch every morning. And there's been just enough rain to make me happy each time. It's been fabulous.
So that is lovely.
I'm a tea drinker, and my first tea in the morning is chai with my protein in it. So that's been my rainy back porch day, and I can recommend rain to, well, you don't have to recommend rain to a Louisiana girl because it rains all the time there.
Yeah.
But to the rest of the world, the dry parts of the world, I don't know how you don't have rain. I don't know how you survive without rain. I'm so sorry that you don't have rain.
Yeah.
Because it's so wonderful to sit out on the porch and just listen to the rain.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My house, I have a back deck. I do have a back deck. But on my front of my house, I have a stone slab that is just wide enough for like two people to stand on and a couple of stairs. And I've always joked that if I did win the Powerball, I would build a porch.
Oh, yeah.
I would have a porch on my front because I'm so like that's so much part of that culture that I grew up in is like you have the front porch and Grams would have a rocking chair out there and she'd sit out there.
Oh, yeah.
If you wanted to talk to Grams, you had to go sit on the porch with her because that's where she was. People watching.
Same with my grandparents. Yeah. Yep. Watching the people go by on the front porch with us in the swing.
Yep.
Or the rocking chair. There are always two rocking chairs and a two-person swing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would gather there. And they came in before they went inside for supper. Everybody would gather and they'd be sitting, talking about their day, waving to the neighbors, breathing the mosquito, killing
stuff. Riding the bikes right behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. And they did. And I feel so sorry for those kids but who grew up to not have a brain. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How about you, Tracy? Pick.
So this is a serious pick in the sense that I really mean it and I think this is a good and fun thing, but it's also a little bit of a dig at myself because folks who have listened to the podcast for a while have noticed that sometimes there's a pattern where I try to make sure that my pick ties in some way to something that feels like themey to our guest. And I had this idea of that there was a game that we had recently played when some friends had come over and it had been a while since it had hit the table last. We all had a great time and I remembered it and I went, this is perfect. The book is set in Tennessee. Like this is absolutely like a huge part of the culture down there. This will be the perfect game to talk about. And then I'm doing my show notes and getting ready. And I'm like,
illegal horse racing for betting purposes has been illegal in Tennessee since the early part of the 20th century.
And I'm like, well, shit. So my pick is still the game Ready, Set, Bet. But apparently it's not Tennessee appropriate because you can't actually bet on horse races in Tennessee. That's, you know, Kentucky, which is not the same thing. So the game Ready, Set, Bet is a really delightful, fun game that plays a kind of wide range of numbers of players. I'm actually double checking the box right now. I should have double checked this before I started yakking. It'll play 2 to 9, which is a really unusual set of numbers.
Yeah.
And it works the way that it does because it works best if you if you download the free app. And I know people are like, I don't want to put apps on stuff. Trust me, this one's worth it because Ready, Set, Bet, as you might guess from the name and me talking about horse racing, is a horse racing game. And you yourself are not racing horses. You are betting on virtual horses that are racing. And so what happens when you get the app, which I recommend if you have like a tablet of some kind, it makes a nice screen for it. We put it on my iPad and you stick it up and you've got the whole sort of like, you know, place and show and win. And you've got a certain number of tokens that you can put down and it's played in real time. So that when you press the button on the app that starts the race, we've got horses that are numbered 1 through 12. And what's happening in the game is the app, if you don't have the app, there's a person running who has to run the game and basically can't play it. So it kind of sucks for them, which is another reason to, you know, get the app. The app is simulating rolling 2 6-sided die. And it takes the sum of that roll and it tells you based on that, like how far a given horse is advancing. And all these rolls are happening in real time. All the bets are happening in real time. There's rules about you can't put multiple markers on the same horse. So if someone puts it in a certain place, they've got that particular claim. And you are basically, it's just invisible money, right? I mean, it's monopoly money, right? That you are betting in the interests of winning lots in a horse race. It is fun. It is easy to learn because of the app assist. Everybody can be engaged and it's very easy. It just runs itself effectively. And because it's one of those great games to do that doesn't require a big teach, it doesn't, you know, you don't necessarily need somebody who's like, oh, what's my strategy? There's no strategy. Just like bet on the invisible ponies. Everything's fun. And yeah, so the whole thing plays in about 40 minutes, 45, depending on how many players you have. It would be a great beer and pretzels sort of game for hanging out with friends. And if you have not heard of it before, had a chance to try it out, I really recommend checking out Ready, Set, Bet.
Very cool. Is there an expansion to it where it teaches you how to make like gigantic fancy paper hats to wear?
There is an expansion to it, apparently, but it is not, in fact, related to gigantic hats or derby pie or, you know, any of that stuff.
No mint juleps.
Yeah.
When you play that game, when you bring that game to the table, I know that you cook for everybody who comes and sits down at the table. Mm-hmm. Do you make pimento cheese sandwiches for folks or?
No. I mean, I guess, but to your point, if you really wanted to like theme it up here, like you could have a little horse racing game, Ready, Set, Bet going over here, get yourself a little spinny wheel, get yourself a little craps mat or something. You could go full on casino night, I guess, if you wanted to.
Pimento cheese sandwiches, cucumber salad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Shoe fly pie.
Yeah,
sounds good to me. I might make pimento cheese sandwiches for supper.
All right,
I got to start with my own cheese and Duke's, of course. But yep. You know,
yeah, I mean, I have at least you know you're in control.
I have an aunt that when she found out how much I do love pimento cheese, she started making pimento cheese and sending it to me, which I thought was kind of very kind of her.
Well, it has been a total delight talking to you, Faith, even if we spent like 70% of the time talking about things in our books. But if there are people out there, and I'm sure there are, who are interested in your books and all the super cool stuff that you do in them, where should they find you and the wonderful things that you make?
I have a website, which most people do, but not a lot of people go to websites these days. They go to social media. I am at faithhunter.net. I am Faith Hunter I think it's Faith Hunter Writer on Instagram and on Facebook. And then I have a personal Facebook page, and I have a fan Facebook page, and I have mostly Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Facebook and Insta. Although I do have a new TikTok. I have a new YouTube page, which my PR person is handling. I am not, so I can't even tell you where they are. That's embarrassing. I now realize I should have at least written all that stuff down so I could tell you, but you can find me in lots of places
sure.
that I don't know about.
The Google powers will take care of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you guys for being so much fun. I appreciate it. You have a great, great day.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know, I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent. So you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know. It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake. Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry. Do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.